and this is episode 4. I'm Gail.
And I'm Daphne.
And we're re-recording this intro for the 87th time because we keep fucking it up. So, that being said, we want to say that all of the suspects in this case are alleged, and Daphne's going to tell you how to get in touch with us and about our Instagram and those sort of things.
Yeah, and I'm the one who keeps fucking this up as you look at me and go, bleh. Anyway, Instagram is at That's Disturbing Podcast. Our email is thatsdisturbingpodcast@gmail.com. And if you feel like moseying on over to the website, it's thatsdisturbingpodcast.com. When you go to the website as well, you can send us a case request form. You can also do that, just an email form as well. But anyway, yeah, suspects alleged, and we'll take it away from here. Thanks, Mom.
Thanks, Daph.
Woo! Ooh,
we just high-fived. You can't see that, but we just high-fived.
Yeah, the visual is not there with the audio.
Yeah, it's missing.
So anyway, I'm going to tell you guys my
disturbing fact.
Sorry, it's late. I'm really tired. And it's probably not even that late, but I'm really tired. So whatever. Okay, so Daphne, this is super freaking disturbing.
Do tell.
McDonald's in 2014 decided that they were going to try to make Happy Meals a little bit more healthy. But in order to do that, they have to make it alluring for little kids. So they freaking developed a bubblegum flavored broccoli. I'm not even shitting you right now. You should see the look on Daphne's face. Not even shitting you right now.
I went from, how can I get a Happy Meal? I'm so excited. How can I con my mom to go and to take me to get one tonight? To, bubblegum flavored broccoli.
Yeah.
What's next? Cotton candy? Kill me now. Gross.
Cotton candy flavored green beans.
Ew. Oof,
no, I don't know. So anyway, so they tested it amongst children, which would be their focus group, their target audience. And guess what?
Everybody puked.
Yeah, they totally didn't like it at all. So it didn't become a thing. And they scrapped it from the Happy Meal prototype menu or whatever. And instead they added like Go-Gurt and apple slices and stuff like that. So they kept it traditional instead of trying to go way fucking far outside of the box. Because I feel like bubblegum flavored broccoli is very far outside of any kind of box that any of us would want to be near or in. Or on top of
or on top of those boxes.
Right. So anyway, yep, that's my disturbing fact for the episode, week, day.
Yeah, that's pretty gnarly, yeah, honestly. It's
disgusting.
Yeah, it's pretty freaking gross. Yeah. Pardon my French. I was trying not to say I'm going to fucking puke if I hear that again.
Yeah, and it's true. I'm not making it up.
That's good. I'm happy you're a truth teller.
Yes.
Yes, I am. I'm a truther, man.
Truther.
All right. So the case that I'm bringing to you guys today, it's one I'm hoping Mom has not heard of.
I have not, I think.
Yeah, because you don't know.
Exactly.
Until right now. It's the case of Maria Ridolf. I think that's how you say her name. Yeah, Maria Ridolf. So she was born March 12th, 1950. Her parents were Michael and Frances Ivy Ridolf. She was born in Sycamore, Illinois. And at the time, Sycamore was mainly a farm town. And many residents of the town were all farm employees. But she was just one of, like, five, I think, of them. Like, very limited number of factories. Most people there worked on farms.
Okay.
So he worked in a factory, and Frances, she was a homemaker and a stay-at-home mom.
What kind of a factory?
I don't know.
Okay.
I'm not sure what kind of a factory.
Okay.
But not a farm.
All right, gotcha.
That's pretty relevant to the story.
Okay, gotcha.
Not a farm. She was the youngest of four children. She had two sisters and a brother, and her mother described her as being high-strung, that she was a nervous girl, and when she got in trouble, she would become hysterical, and that she was also a screamer.
God, I hate screamers.
That's why I looked right at you dead in the eyes when I said the screamer.
Yeah, children should not be allowed to scream.
No, they shouldn't. No. I hate screaming children as well.
Yeah, it's a bad, bad thing.
Yeah, they're the worst.
Yep.
So at the time that she was abducted, she was 7 years old. She was about 44 inches tall. She weighed 53 pounds. She had brown hair and brown eyes. And she was an honor student in her second grade class. I can just, like, imagine how cute that is. That
I feel like she's tall, though, because that's, she's almost 4 feet tall, and she's 7. But I guess that's irrelevant to the story.
I mean, I feel like, look at your little niece. She's pretty tall. She's almost as tall as me.
Okay, that's fair.
Yeah, and she's 8.
Right, okay.
So, yeah, it's not too bad.
Nope. Okay.
Yeah, she was an honor student in her second grade class, and she received awards through her church, the Evangelical Lutheran Church of St. John, for perfect attendance.
Aw, that's good.
Isn't that cute?
That's so cute.
So, on December 3rd, 1957, this was the tragic day that everything unfolded. Maria and her best friend, 8-year-old Kathy Sigmund, who was a neighbor of the family, she lived down the street. Again, they're all farm properties in this area,
mm-hmm.
Rural area.
Right.
They begged to go outside after dinner, and they wanted to play, and it had just begun to snow. So they're a little bit bundled up, not totally bundled up. And they were wanting to play their favorite game by Maria's house, which was called Duck the Cars.
Oh, wow. That seems safe.
I was just about to say, get a load of this. So the game has them running back and forth across the road to try and avoid the headlights of oncoming traffic in the street.
What the fuck? I'm sorry. That does not seem like a safe...
Yeah, we're not laughing at anything that's unfolded. We're laughing at what the fuck.
Right. That doesn't seem like one of your more safe childhood games that you want to play.
Right. And I feel like everybody's always talking about, like, before this current era of, like, technology and everything, that it was just different, right? That people would play outside and do all these different things, that it was just different. However, there were still cars that could hit you.
Yeah. Yeah, dodging cars at night doesn't seem like a really good idea.
Yeah, no, it doesn't.
But they're 7. But where are their parents?
What?
Where are the parents? Why aren't the parents like, hey, I feel like that's not a good game
for probably because they didn't know what they were playing.
Yeah, that's probably true.
But they were like, I guess they were like basically right outside of Maria's house. So maybe like a good stretch away. Again, rural area, probably a little bit of land.
Okay.
So maybe a little bit of a stretch away. Like her friend, Kathy, lived down the street, I guess. So, yeah, neighbors. But, you know, rural neighborhood. So there also weren't that many cars coming by. When I say traffic, I'm not talking about, like, I-25 traffic. Which I feel like that would actually be pretty easy to dodge because it doesn't move.
Well, there's that.
So, according to Kathy, they were approached by a man when they were playing this game. And Kathy later described to the police that he was in his early 20s, and he was tall with a slender chin. He had light hair, a gap in his teeth, and he was wearing a colorful sweater. So the man, and he identified himself as Johnny to them.
Of course he did.
Told the girls he was 24 and not married.
Why did they care?
Right. And then he asked if they liked dolls and if they liked piggyback rides.
Okay, I can see where this is real creepily heading.
Yeah, red flags.
Yeah, a lot of
red flags all over the place.
Yeah.
So he gave Maria a piggyback ride. And then what happens next, there's two versions of this story. And those two versions are accounted to the fact that Kathy was young. And so her memory is probably unclear at this time. She was only 8 years old.
Okay.
So, the first version is that Maria ran back into her home after getting a piggyback ride from Johnny to grab a doll to show to Johnny. And in this time, while she was running back inside of her house, that the man had inappropriately touched Kathy. And then after Maria returned, Kathy ran back to her house to grab a pair of mittens because it was cold outside, it was snowing.
Mm-hmm.
And then when she returned, Marie and the man were gone.
Oof, that's bad.
And then the other version had nothing to do with Johnny inappropriately touching Kathy, and that she just went to go get gloves. Maria never left the situation. She went to go grab her mittens, and then she came back and they were gone.
That's so sad.
Isn't that horrible?
Right.
So she immediately started looking for her. And then when she was like, this isn't going anywhere, she bolted into the Ridolf's house and was screaming that she couldn't find Maria. She didn't know where Maria was. And the family was like, oh, she's probably just being silly. She's probably just hiding and playing a prank, right? As I feel like is the innocent place that our minds would go to, not, oh, fuck, my kid just got abducted.
Right, you don't immediately go there. Unless Kathy tells you that some creepy kid named Johnny is giving piggyback rides.
Right.
Then you go there.
Yeah.
I'm assuming Kathy hasn't brought that information out yet.
I don't think she has at this moment in time. So, anyway, they send Maria's brother out there, who was 11 years old, to go look for Maria.
Jeez. Well, and then, one of our kids is missing. Let's see if we can have another one go missing.
Yeah, I don't like this.
Yeah, that's not...
It's so sad, because, I mean, in hindsight, like, obviously, things would have been done 100 million times differently, I'm assuming. But, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know.
It's so sad, though, nonetheless.
Right.
So, when he came back without her, the brother, they called the police. And within the hour, the same hour. So when Maria's brother, Charles, came back without her, they called the police. And within the same hour, there were police there and armed civilians looking for Maria.
Yeah, as there should be.
Right, she's an innocent little 7-year-old girl that had just gone missing.
Right, and if they find Johnny, they're going to just shoot him. Shoot on sight.
Yeah.
Right?
If only.
Well... They're armed civilians in the 50s in a rural area.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying, hopefully.
Right.
So, Maria and Johnny at this point had vanished without a trace. And the FBI presumed she had been abducted by this man and taken across state lines when they interjected into the investigation about 2 days into it. And then the FBI and police interviewed a number of witnesses, including people who had seen the two girls playing outside.
Dodging cars.
Yeah, dodging cars.
People who almost hit the two girls.
Right.
In the middle of the street.
So I'm going to break down a little bit of a timeline here. This kind of gets confusing. So bear with me.
Okay.
So the two girls were seen playing alone, no other person there, from 6 to 6:30, or in that time frame, right? 6 to 6:30, playing alone. By themselves, nobody else there. And family members and people who had seen them corroborated they were by themselves from this time period. When Kathy went to go get her mittens, or maybe Maria went to go get her doll in this time frame, that's when they suspect that Johnny had probably approached them at about roughly 6:30, because then by the time Kathy got back from getting her mittens and the two of them were gone, it was in the window of 6:45 to 7 o'clock.
Okay.
So that's kind of the little rough breakdown of the timeline. A little bit confusing. It confused me when I was reading it. Anyway, the searches later turned up Maria's doll.
Aww.
I know. It's so sad. Yeah. They had roadblocks and there were even helicopters looking for her. And military vehicles, like, you name it.
They but I'm guessing, for her. Sorry, I'm guessing this is, like, days later, not, like, right away, because the FBI is involved and helicopters and all of that. Those are probably in the next days, like, not the first day.
Yeah, no, the FBI interjected 2 days into the investigation.
Right.
And this whole thing captured national attention. President, Eisenhower,
yeah.
Yeah, President Eisenhower got involved in it. The FBI's main dude at the time, he also got...
Was it J. Edgar Hoover?
I don't think so.
Oh, okay. Just throwing that out there, I don't know.
Yeah, you weren't around back then?
I was not.
Okay. Yeah, they had all spoken out publicly as well, too, to help try and bring this sweet little girl home. And... since Kathy was the only witness to see Johnny, everybody agreed it was the best place for her protection to be in police custody. So then that way, he wasn't going to come after her, like he couldn't get to her if she was the only witness. Like, he couldn't come after her and do anything to her, abduct her, kidnap her.
Right, but if the whole country is looking for you and armed civilians in your town are looking for you, I feel like he's not coming back. But yeah, it's probably safer to do that.
Right, it definitely would be safer to do that. So police pulled all the files of people that they had named Johnny or John or anyone that fit the description that Kathy had given to them. And Kathy identified Thomas Joseph Rivard in a police lineup. Thomas John Rivard was a 35-year-old man at the time who was 5'4 and weighed 156 pounds with dark blonde wavy hair. However, he had an alibi for the time of the crime. Get this. He was already in jail.
Oh, well, then he couldn't have done it, but he's clearly...
So he thought that he got picked for the lineup just as, like, a fill-in for somebody else, like as some kind of a corruption thing happening. That's what his personal thought was, why he got picked to get put in the lineup. Because Kathy chose him, right? And right. He was in jail.
Right, so he didn't do it.
Yeah, he obviously didn't do it.
Right.
And then it also came out later that Kathy didn't even remember identifying Rivard.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
I wonder if she's just shook or if she just is 8 and can't remember anything.
Right, if she's blacked this time in her life out.
Right.
Because I'm sure it'd be mentally scarring to have any of these memories on you.
Right, exactly.
So, yeah, like I said, this case received a lot of coverage nationwide. Everybody's on the lookout for her. They're on the lookout for a potential suspect, right? And so law enforcement, they continue to investigate any suspects within the area, including local sex offenders. Get this, a local man who liked to give kids piggyback rides. That guy existed.
Wow.
And transients in the town, but no leads turned up from this.
I'm still kind of hung up on the piggyback giver, and that he's like known for that in the town.
This guy,
yeah.
Well, that's not John.
No, I know. That's just some random guy that is known to give piggyback rides.
It's okay. I'm the campus crier.
Yeah, well, we all have to be good at something,
right? Okay, it's cool. Let me do this for the rest of my life.
Instead of giving children piggyback rides or
yeah,
in addition to?
No, in lieu of.
Okay, sounds good.
So law enforcement involved in the case had a list of suspects. So we're going to go through the first suspect right now. It was John Tezier.
Okay.
I'm not sure how you say it. Who was born as John Cherry. And he was born in November of 1939 in Belfast, Northern Ireland, to his parents Samuel Cherry and his wife Eileen McCullough Cherry. And his father was a British sergeant who was killed early during World War II. And his mother served as one of the first female airplane spotters in the UK's Royal Air Force. And after her husband had passed, she met a man named Ralph Tessier, who was an American soldier stationed in the UK. And so after the war, Eileen and Ralph married, and then they relocated with 7-year-old John to Sycamore, Illinois.
Okay.
And John would end up being the oldest of 7 children. The family's home was located right around the corner from the Riddle's house, so it was less than 2 blocks away.
Yeah, but wouldn't they then know this guy?
Yeah, they do.
So he's named as a suspect? But Kathy wasn't like, oh yeah, for sure it was that guy that lives around the corner?
Just wait for it a moment.
Okay, sorry. Jumping ahead.
Yes, you were.
How bad?
So John was a sign painter, and he was known to paint some of the signs on police cars, like do some of the artwork on the outside of police cars. I guess not necessarily artwork, but right. Writing police and paint.
I guess it's not. Well, art is subjective.
That's true. But that's objectively not art.
That's super anyway. Funny. Writing police.
Okay.
He was expelled in 10th grade for pushing and verbally assaulting his teacher. And then at the time of the crime, he was 18 and living at his parents' house. On December 4th, investigators visited the Tezier home.
December 4th?
I know.
Oh, I recognize that date.
Well, that's like 50 years before my birthday.
I know, but it's still your birthday.
Or 40.
I don't know. We don't have to do math because it's late. But your birthday's in December.
21 on years. The
4th. Okay, read. Get back on it.
Something like that.
What year is it?
1957.
Okay, we're not going to do math, but it's way more than 21 years before your birthday.
And yeah, that's true.
Jeez. It's a good thing you're not a math major.
Yeah, right. I used to do that.
Clearly, that's why you stopped.
Uh-huh. On December 4th, investigators visited the Tezier home as part of their neighborhood search for Maria. According to the Teziers, I hope I'm saying that right. I don't know. Anyway, the half-sisters, Catherine and Jean, and their mother told the investigators that John had been home on the night of December 3rd, and that was later testified as it was not true, that was a lie. So Tezier and his parents informed FBI investigators that Tezier was in Rockford, Illinois, some 40 miles northwest of Sycamore, on December 3rd, 1957. Oh, fuck. But it's still showing that we're recording.
I know, but it's not red.
Fuck. I hope we didn't lose all of that. It's still showing that we're recording, though.
Okay. Well.
Hopefully. Okay. Anyway, let me restart that part. Tezier, why couldn't you just touch it?
I don't know. Because my hands are in my pockets.
All right. Tezier and his parents informed FBI investigators that Tezier was in Rockford, Illinois, that's some 40 miles north of Sycamore, on December 3rd, to enlist in the Air Force. This tale contradicted his mother's previous assertion, as relayed by her children, that Tezier had been home all night, because if he was enlisting for the Air Force 40 miles away from his house versus being home all night, those are two way different stories, right?
Well, yeah, for sure. Yeah, if you're 40 miles away from home, then you're not home. So it's different than being home.
It's like you're, well, yeah, for sure. So he stated that he was in Chicago on December 2nd and 3rd to undergo the physical testing for his enrollment. And on December 3rd, he went to Chicago's recruiting station, which was confirmed by the records there. I think it's a military area, right? They have to confirm you.
Right.
So, and then he spent the day sightseeing in Chicago.
Okay, well, can I also say, why did they have to make up a lie and lie for him that he's home if he was in Chicago?
Right.
Like, what's the point?
Sorry, we're still laughing. So, yeah, right.
All the time. It's my catchphrase.
Yeah, it is.
Right?
Right. Basically. So, then he spent the day sightseeing in Chicago before returning to Rockford by train in that evening, arriving at 6:45 p.m. He had called his parents upon landing in Rockford to request a ride home to Sycamore because he had taken the train to and from Chicago and had left his car at home. Telephone records later revealed that at 6:57 that evening, a collect call was put from the Rockford post office to the Tezier home by someone who gave his identity as John Tezier. And as written down by the operator, was John Tezier.
That's so crazy that they had phone records like that back then.
I know. Yeah. Isn't that weird to think about it?
It is weird. And plus, there's an operator. Like,
now you don't have that?
No, you don't have that.
Right?
Collect call from John Tezier. To accept the charges, say yes. Or hang up if not.
Yeah, basically.
Yeah.
Tezier then met with officers.
You gotta cut that out.
From the recruiting station. Why?
Because that sounds stupid.
Tezier then met with police from the Rockford recruiting station to send off papers for his enrollment after making the call. The cops acknowledged speaking with Tezier at 7:15 that evening. However, one officer, He raised reservations to the other officers about this guy doesn't seem very trustworthy. He just seems off. This guy just seems off to us.
Okay.
So he was taken to the police station and then identified. Then he was given, administered, can't English.
It's hard.
A lie detector test, which he passed. And then Tessier was taken off the suspect list due to his alibi and the lie detector test results. As we know, as we've talked about before, polygraph tests, they're a double-edged sword. They really can't be used in court, or at least not anymore. I don't know about back then what the rules looked like for that. But they can't be, they're not admissible in court anymore. And, like, if you're a good liar, you could probably get away with it.
Yeah, exactly.
So, he was, keep losing my place.
Do tell what he was.
So they closed his report on December 10th of 1957, noting no further investigation is being done about the subject. So they just closed him as a suspect.
Right. Because he was in Chicago.
Right.
Yeah.
So Kathy Sigmund was never shown a photo of him or questioned about his identity. And then Tessier left the Sycamore the next day to report to Lackland Air Force Base for basic training. And it's, like, just very sus over here. And then he's, like, the next day he's, like, well, I'm leaving for the military.
Right. And that they didn't even show pictures to her. But she also picked somebody out of a lineup who was in jail at the same time as Maria right. was being abducted, so.
But she's a little baby 8-year-old.
I know. Well, she's not a reliable witness.
Yeah.
So that's probably why they didn't. And if he literally was in Chicago, then no matter what, he couldn't have done it. Except if they for sure knew he was in Chicago, then why did they do a polygraph test?
Right.
Yeah.
Confusing.
Super confusing.
Yeah.
And a waste of taxpayers' money.
Yeah, fuck that. I was like, what can I say about that? Fuck that.
Right?
So, Tessier, over his career in the military, he went from being just a regular Joe Schmo in the Air Force, and then he rose to being a captain over his 13-year time frame there. And then, after leaving the military, he went to Seattle. And there, he graduated from King County Law Enforcement Academy in June of 1974 and went on to work as a police officer in the small town of Lacey, that's near Olympia. And then he eventually joined Milton Police Department, where he clashed with the chief of police, who attempted to terminate him very often. But get a load of this. So Tessier, with the kind sweetheart he has, he decided to take in a 15-year-old girl and her friend that were runaways. And they knew him as being this police officer, right?
So, of course, and it's also the 70s where you're trained to trust police officers. Not that you shouldn't trust police officers, but in our day and age, you're trained just not to trust anybody. Because anybody can be a bad person. It doesn't matter who you are. Or what your stature in the community is, or what your job is. You just can't trust anybody anymore. But yeah, back then, if you were a police officer, you definitely would have people's trust.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Isn't that also the age of, like, the free spirit, though, too?
Yeah. But still. I mean, kids also are going to be raised to respect the police, whether or not they do or not. But it's going to be like that, you know, respect your teachers, respect the police, respect your elders, all that kind of right. stuff. And before that, don't take candy from strangers. Don't help a stranger find a puppy. Don't get into the white van.
Yep.
All of those things.
Yeah, crazy times.
Yeah.
They don't just say that, kids. There's meaning behind them. It happened, so listen.
Hopefully there aren't kids listening.
Well, these kids were allowed to play Duck the Car. So who knows what kids are listening to these days.
Right. But if you're listening and you're not old enough to be listening, please turn us off, but tell your parents to listen.
Yes. Yes, please.
And,
there we go.
And subscribe.
Yeah, like and subscribe. Subscribe.
Subscribe and like.
So he took in the 15-year-old, right? Michelle Weinman. and her friend, and they knew her, or they knew him to be a police officer, trusted him. Weinman later testified that he fondled her, and then he performed oral sex on her shortly after she began living with him.
15 years old.
And then he was charged with criminal statutory rape.
Yeah, please, and thank you.
He pled guilty to communicating with a minor for moral intentions.
Yeah, communicating with her.
Yeah, right. More than.
Yeah, that's disgusting.
And then he was given a misdemeanor after he had some plea negotiations.
Ugh, that's such bullshit.
So he was sentenced to 1 year of formal probation. And in March of 1982, he was fired from the Milton Police Department.
Well, that's good, but he should have got more than probation.
Yeah, wholeheartedly agree.
Yeah, and be on a sex offender registry and the whole nine.
So in April 1994, he changed his last name to McCullough.
Of course he did.
Because he wanted to remember his late mother. In 2011, he was then in his 70s. And he resided in a retirement community, and then he worked as a security guard. He's still in Seattle.
Still now? It's 2022.
In 2011.
Okay.
At the time in 2011.
Okay.
Well,
yeah, and of course he changed his last name to honor his mother, or so that people wouldn't know what his last name was and know that he was a frickin' child molester.
Right. Piece of creepy shit. Fuck. On April 26, 1958... near Woodbine, Illinois. That's about 100 miles away from Sycamore, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Frank Sitar and his wife were searching for mushrooms in a wooded area on their friend's farm.
Ooh.
Along U.S. Route 20 when they then discovered the skeletal remains of a small child.
Aww.
I know. She was wearing only a shirt, her undershirt, and her socks. And she was under a partially fallen tree.
Aww.
The decomposed condition of the body indicated that she had been there for several months.
Well, yeah. Yeah, she's skeletal.
Right, from December to April.
That's so sad.
Isn't that depressing?
That's so sad.
Just a cute little girl.
Yeah.
So, it was obviously, where I'm getting to, is they identified the skeletal remains to be Maria through her dental records.
Aww.
And then a lock of her hair as well.
Aww.
And the fact that the shirts and the socks she had on were hers.
Aww.
I know. They were the ones she was wearing at the time of the disappearance. Like,
that
her
makes
mom
me so sad.
Confirmed that. I know. I can't even imagine.
No.
It's horrible.
Yeah, and to be just discarded like a piece of trash.
Right.
That makes me sad.
Yeah, and the rest of her stuff was never found, the rest of her belongings.
Poor little thing.
I know. She's so sweet. You should look up a picture of her.
I will.
She's so cute. Aww. I'm like, I just want to squeeze her.
Yeah.
She's so cute. At this time, there was no known cause of death because of the advanced state of decomposition her body was in. But when they exhumed her body in 2011, they had re-examined her, and experts found that the most likely cause of death for her was that she had been fatally stabbed in the throat.
Aww, and she is cute. I'm looking. There's even a picture of her with her birthday cake. And maybe, is that her friend Kathy?
Maybe.
Maybe. I don't know. That's really sad. She's so cute.
I know. That's why I said, I'm like, she's so fucking cute.
Yeah. People suck.
So now we're going to move on to another person, another suspect. We're going to move on to William Henry Redmond. In 1997, Sycamore Police Lieutenant Patrick Soler closed the, at this point, 40-year-old case. Okay, so there we go. It's 41 years after my birthday.
Or before it.
I'm really pretty, I swear. But it was a 40-year-old case at this point. The Sycamore Police Lieutenant, he had named William Henry Redmond, a former truck driver and carnival worker.
Carny?
Yeah, I was just about to say he was a carny. from Nebraska, who died in 1992 as the suspect in the case of the abduction and murder of cute little Maria.
So why do they do that? Does he have, like, other history of stuff?
Yeah, so he was arrested in 1935 for sexually trafficking two young girls in Ohio, and then again for attempting to rape a preteen girl in 1938.
So how old would he have been at the time of Maria's abduction? Because if he's getting charged with stuff in 1935 and she didn't get abducted until 1957, he would be way more than 24. I mean, granted, he's telling these girls he's 24, but...
I don't know. I try not to spend too much time deep diving into this guy just because there's a lot to cover in this case. Like, all around, there's a lot to cover.
Okay.
And this guy, he might be a fun one for us to dive into one day. He's got a real long rap sheet of things that are not his, that he's just suspected of. So we can get into those now. So he's a suspect in all of these, right? The murder of Joanne Lynn. She was 11 years old, and she was discovered shot to death outside of Rochester, New York, on September 30th, 1949.
Who shoots an 11-year-old?
I know. Jerk.
Yeah, that's terrible.
Yeah, it's so sad. I hate child predators.
I hate bad people.
I do too. I hate bad people as well. Bad people suck.
Yes, they do.
They're the worst.
Yes, they do.
Why can't everybody just shit rainbows and be happy?
Well, because I have no
yang.
I have no answer for that.
Yin and yang.
Sure.
It's
just because some people are pieces of shit.
So, when they had found Joanne Lynn, Redmond, he was working at a carny.
At a carnival as a carny?
At a carnival as a carny, about 9 kilometers away from her murder.
Why did we go metric?
Because that was what the website said. I just didn't feel like breaking it.
2.2 miles in a kilometer. So, it's what? Far. 18-ish miles?
No,
2.2.
No, because a 5K is 3.2. A 10K is 6 miles. So about 5 miles. He was about 5 miles away.
Okay.
There you go.
Okay.
Yeah, roughly about 5 miles.
Sorry, that was a bad train to go down.
Yeah, it was. Then the next one was Jane Marie Althoff. She was 8 years old, and she was found dead in a pickup truck on the grounds of a carnival in South Philadelphia.
Aww.
On April 25th in 1951, and his prints were found in the truck.
And she's just her little sweet girl going to the carnival.
Right?
Wanting some cotton candy and to ride a Ferris wheel.
Yeah.
Aww.
So fucking fucked up.
Yeah, people suck.
Yeah, they do. They're fucked up.
Yep.
The next one, I feel like, is a case that I've heard about a lot. I don't know if you're familiar with it. The case of Beverly Potts.
Nope.
So she was a 10-year-old from Cleveland. And she went to her local carnival on August 24th, 1951. And then she was never seen or heard from again.
Aww.
I know. I feel like probably because she's a blonde, white little girl. Or I don't actually know if she's blonde, but she's a white little girl. Is probably why she's more talked about than other people.
Yeah. Even back then.
Yeah. Well, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And then there was Connie Smith, who was 10 years old when she went missing from her Connecticut YMCA camp in July of 1952, and she was never found. And they really liked Redmond for this case because of where he was at the current time. And then Barbara Gacka's remains were found in an empty lot near Detroit on March 31st of 1955. Upon investigating her disappearance, police concluded that she had been missing she'd been missing for a week, right? That she was raped and murdered the week prior.
Aww.
So she wasn't missing for a week. She was dead for that entire week.
Oh, that's so sad.
I know, all these little baby angels.
Yeah.
So, Redmond was charged in 1988 with the murder of an 8-year-old girl from Pennsylvania in 1951.
Wow. That's quite a stretch of getting away with it.
Yeah.
And probably taking a whole lot of other victims along the way.
Yeah, absolutely. But the case was dropped.
Oh.
Because a police officer refused to give up the identity of a star witness in it.
Well, they don't have to.
So the confidential informant in the case,
mm-hmm.
he couldn't give away the identity, so the case got dropped.
Oh, that just sucks.
This whole case is just like a roller coaster, this whole story.
Yeah, that sucks. Because, I don't know, I just feel like, I don't know, I'm not going to say anything about CIs, because I think they can just keep their identities secret, or they give them like a fake name so that they can testify under whatever, and nobody really knows who the real person is. But I am not a professional person who knows anything about that kind of stuff. It's just from the shows that I watch. And as we've learned, my information from such shows can be misinterpreted or misrepresented or misgiven.
Yep.
Yep.
It's the Yakuza.
Yakuza. Back to that.
Okay. Anyway. Circling it back around to the police lieutenant from Sycamore, according to Patrick Soler, yeah, his name was Patrick, just making sure. According to Patrick Soler, Redmond told a fellow convict that he had committed a crime that was very close to the kidnapping and murder of Ridolph. And he also thought that he resembled Johnny's appearance and demeanor at the time, in 1957.
Mm-hmm.
And his report was slammed for lack of proof, lack of evidence against Redmond. And then they also thought that he had political intentions with trying to, like, close out this case.
Mm-hmm.
And Soler admitted that even if he had evidence against Redmond, it would all be circumstantial, and that if Redmond had lived, convicting him would be impossible unless he confessed. So, as a result to this, Soler closed the case. He stamped it with a closed but not solved on Maria Ridolph's case.
Aww.
I know. So, not really closed if it's not solved.
Yeah, and it doesn't remain open as a cold case. They just
closed it.
Because the guy that they think did it died. So they're just calling it a day.
Right. So now we're going to bring it back around to the case being reopened in 2008.
Ooh.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah, so the case got reopened in 2008 due to new information from McCullough, remember?
Yeah, the child molester police officer.
Yeah. What was the last name? I don't know. I just want to call him
Tussier?
Terrier?
Something.
Who cares?
Yeah, basically.
Ah, now I need to find it. Tessier. Yeah, so the case was reopened in 2008 due to new information from McCullough's half-sister, Janet. Their mother, Eileen, she was terminally ill with cancer in 1994, and while on her deathbed, she looked at Janet and she said, "Those two little girls, the one that disappeared, John did it, and you have to tell someone."
Aww.
Yeah. Right?
Okay, but I thought it was in Chicago. And records from the military even said that.
Yeah. Yeah. So, Janet interpreted the statement to mean that her half-brother, John Tessier, a.k.a. John McCullough, had kidnapped and murdered Maria Ridolph, and she had also learned from her older sisters, Catherine and Jeannie, that Eileen lied to investigators about him being home on the night of the crime. Mary Pat, another one of McCullough's half-sisters.
Yeah, because there were seven kids.
There were seven of them.
Yeah.
Yeah. I also feel like this is a good time to cut in here and say that I couldn't find any. Some sources kept calling him Jack McCullough, that he had changed his name from John to Jack McCullough.
Well, it's common for Johns to be called Jack back then. Because, like, John F. Kennedy, they called him Jack.
That's dumb.
And I think their dad was also named John, and they called him Jack. I don't know. It's weird.
It is. It's weird. But I couldn't find if he actually got his name changed or not to Jack from... I just felt like I needed to tell you this right now because I forgot to mention it before.
Yeah.
That there were some sources that kept calling him Jack McCullough and some that kept calling him John McCullough.
Well, they didn't... He probably didn't change his name. It's just that whole interchanging of John and Jack.
Okay.
Which I don't understand because it's not the same name.
Yeah, it's not, right? It's not shortened for it either.
No. But it was a thing.
Okay.
Yeah.
An odd one.
Yep.
So Mary Pat, another one of McCullough's half-sisters, she was also present when Eileen spoke to Janet. And she testified that she had only heard her mother say he did it.
So she doesn't know what the mother was talking about necessarily.
So they came together, the two sisters, and agreed that that was that she was talking about.
Okay.
And Eileen, who was a cancer patient, she was on morphine, like a crazy amount of morphine at the time. Like I said, she was on her deathbed. And according to her doctor, she was disoriented. And McCullough, who allegedly threatened Janet with a gun and sexually abused his half-sister, Jean, as a minor, had become estranged from the Tessier family by the time Eileen died. He was told not to come to the funeral. He wasn't welcome there by his family.
Well, yeah, no kidding. If you molest one of your own sisters, albeit half or not, and threaten your family with a weapon.
Piece of shit.
Yeah, no, don't come to the funeral.
No. Right? Absolutely not.
Unless we push you in the grave also. But we don't want to do that to the poor mom.
No.
Right.
Don't want her to be down there with him for eternity.
No, exactly.
So, over the next 14 years after Janet listened to her mom make those remarks, she was trying and trying and trying. She was trying to get into contact with the Sycamore Police Department and the FBI, and the FBI kept redirecting her to the Sycamore Police Department, who didn't want anything to do with it. And Patrick Soler, the Sycamore, again, police department chief, or lieutenant, I'm sorry, who had identified William Henry Redmond as the most likely suspect in the Ridolph murder, told CNN that Janet had never spoken to him, but that he would not have suspected John Tessier because he knew the Tessier family, and John Tessier had painted the Sycamore police cars.
With artwork.
And had been cleared by the FBI in 1957. So at this point, Janet emailed the police tip line in 2008, prompting the state police cold case team to conduct a lengthy investigation into McCullough's background and alibi. Janet's sister Catherine and Jean informed investigators of their concerns, and Jean claimed that John had abused her and other young females. Another woman claimed that as a child, John Tessier gave her a piggyback ride and refused to let her go until her father intervened.
Jeez, here we go with the piggyback rides again.
I know, it's so weird. Right? The piggyback rides. Oh. So, state police...
And I'm not going to let you go. I'm forcing you to have a piggyback ride.
Right? Weird.
Yeah.
State police investigators looked at the evidence and made a new timeline that shows how Tessier could have taken Maria and driven to Rockford in the time to make a phone call at 6:57 and meet with the recruiting officers at 7:15.
Mm.
According to this new timeline, Maria would have had to have been kidnapped no later than 6:20. And according to Catherine, the search for Maria was underway by 7 p.m. when she arrived home when she saw the search party in action down the street from their house.
So that sounds plausible. Because the timeline is based on what Kathy said.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you're a little kid, time's like forever.
Right. Stand still.
Well, not necessarily stand still, but like 5 minutes can seem like 3 hours.
Still feels that way now sometimes.
Sometimes it does. I'm not going to argue with you on that.
Right. It's a long time.
Can be.
So, police grabbed 5 images from the 1957 Sycamore High School yearbook in the hopes of having Kathy Sigmund again, Maria's BFF.
Mm-hmm.
And she does change her name at this point to reflect her married name.
Yeah, I was going to say she's married,
so
right?
She's Kathy,
not eight anymore.
She's Kathy Sigmund Chapman at this point. And so they were hoping to have her look at a photo lineup. However, John Tessier's picture was not in the school yearbook because he had been expelled in 10th grade.
Oh, yeah.
So the police acquired a photograph from Tessier's ex-girlfriend at the time, which these pictures highly differed from the yearbook pictures because he was not wearing a suit and there was no photo retouch on this, like, at all, right? Or no flash. I guess they didn't have retouch then, but no flash. And it was taken in a dark, it was a darker background rather than a light background.
Mm-hmm.
And at this point, Kathy, she recognized him in the pictures.
Well, that's weird.
Yeah.
It's really weird that the ex-girlfriend still has pictures of him.
Oh, yeah.
I'm kind of hung up on that for just a split second.
Yeah, I wholeheartedly agreed, but I've seen your pictures of your ex-boyfriend from high school. So.
Yep, okay.
Yeah, moving on. In addition to the photograph, Tessier's ex-girlfriend offered an unused military-issued rail ticket from Rockford to Chicago in December of 1957.
And it was unused.
It was unused.
And she had the ticket too, like a concert ticket?
That's why I'm like, you're concerned about the photos. The investigators interpreted this that this was contrary to his alibi,
mm-hmm.
that he drove there.
Mm-hmm.
And so he had driven to Chicago instead of taking the train. So he may have had time to drive back to Sycamore on December 3rd, kidnap Maria, and then driven to Rockford.
Yeah, sounds like it.
Yeah, it does.
Especially if he lied that he frickin' took the train and he didn't take the train.
Right.
Yeah, okay.
He's a piece of shit.
So we're back to Jack McCullough.
Yep. We're back to Jack. Back to Jack. The police tracked down Tessier's high school classmate, who remembered seeing Tessier's distinctively painted automobile in Sycamore that afternoon, and that Tessier never allowed anybody else to drive his car. So okay. He had painted his own car.
Right, with some artwork.
Maybe. Maybe
or he just
police.
Wrote his name on it. Jack.
Jack. A.K.A. John. In July of 2011, the Seattle Police Department, which had joined forces at this point with the Illinois State Police, started to zero in. They started questioning McCullough. And because, remember how I said he used to be a part of the police force?
Yeah, but he wasn't in Seattle. He was in a different town. But that's okay, because if it's still in King County, it's King County.
Well, they used a trained interrogator due to his law enforcement experience. That he knew what this was going to look like.
Well, plus he's a murderer and a child molester and who knows what else. So he's probably good at lying.
Yeah, right? He has to be at this point.
Right.
So he first spoke quietly and was cooperative with the questioning.
Of course he was.
But then when he was confronted about Maria Rudolph's death and his whereabouts the night of the crime, he suddenly became evasive, very hostile, didn't want anything to do with it. So then he was placed under arrest for kidnapping and murdering Maria Rudolph.
Good.
And he was extradited to Illinois because he refused to answer any questions.
Good.
Yeah. So, like I said, Maria's body was exhumed in 2011.
Ooh, I didn't hear you say that.
Okay, you weren't listening. That's great. So, her body was exhumed in 2011.
Okay.
It was
first time hearing of it.
It was to look for DNA evidence, but they couldn't find any. And remember how I said that she was fatally stabbed?
Yeah.
That's how they figured that out, was in 2011.
Oh, well, that's what I was wondering when you said that she was fatally stabbed, because I was like, if her body is decomposing under a log in a field, how do they know that she's been fatally stabbed?
Well, if you had been listening, I said they exhumed her body and figured out that that was her cause of death, because they couldn't determine it at the time.
Okay, well, that's what happens when I'm really, really tired. But I'm paying attention to the whole rest of it. I just missed the 2011 part.
The 2011?
Yep.
It's literally what you said.
I know. I heard it.
So they exhumed her body to try and find some DNA evidence. And then a forensic anthropologist discovered that she had been stabbed in the throat at least 3 times with a long, sharp blade pointing to nicks in her sternum and in her neck vertebrae that were compatible with at least 3 cuts to her throat.
Man, it has to be deep to get your vertebrae.
Yeah.
That's so sad.
Isn't that horrible?
Yeah, that poor little girl.
I know.
I hope it, I hate to say, but I hope it got, killed her on the very first one.
Yeah.
And he just
so she didn't have to suffer.
Yeah, and he just did the extra 2 for overkill.
Yeah.
Because that's heartbreaking.
I hope so, too.
Yeah.
I really hope so, too. So it was thought that stabbing was the most likely cause of death. But then an appellate court later said that the findings did not rule out other possible ways of her dying. So it could have also been ligature strangling, which they wouldn't have any way to know of because of the ligaments and the soft tissue being decomposed.
Right.
So, but they're going with the fact that it's probably the most likely thing. And they didn't find any DNA evidence on her either because, again, decomposed.
Right.
They couldn't even identify her through anything other than her
dental records.
Yeah.
And her socks and her shirt.
Yeah. I know.
So sad.
Poor little baby. Makes me very mad. The arrest in the 54-year-old murder case at this time was received and it was super widespread. Everybody was calling their attention to it to see what's going to happen. And so the DeKalb County State's Attorney, Clay Campbell, was hesitant to take the case because of its age and lack of physical evidence linking McCullough to the killing. He formally charged McCullough with the kidnapping and murder of Maria after being persuaded by the Ridolph and Tessier families, who all believed that McCullough was guilty.
Good, I'm glad.
So when Jack McCullough, we're going to call him that, Jack, John, whatever, McCullough, we're going to move forward with the name McCullough because that's who he's identifying as at this point. So when McCullough was tried in the Ridolph case, the trial judge ruled out any testimony about the previous guy that they thought was, that they suspected was the murderer, Redmond.
Yeah.
On the grounds that he was not a credible suspect anymore for the case.
Okay.
So
he's just a piece of shit in a lot of other different ways.
The defense couldn't use that, any of that against.
Good.
For the case against McCullough.
Good. I'm glad.
So, the prosecution started in September 2012, and they said that they assumed that he was drawn to Maria and that he decided to kidnap her, but instead he killed her. And through this, they were citing the new autopsy data that was indicating that she was stabbed to death, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then, despite the prosecutor's suspicions that McCullough molested Maria, they were unable to prove anything about her being molested because of no DNA evidence.
Right.
Numerous witnesses also testified for the prosecution, including members of Maria's family, neighbors, law enforcement employees, Kathy, her best friend from growing up, and she was the star witness who recognized McCullough as Johnny, the man who approached her and Maria 50 years ago.
Good. Well, and that more fits with the age because that other guy, that Redmond or whatever, if he was already being arrested in 1934, no way even to an 8-year-old does he look 24 years old in 1957.
Right, but I mean, she thought that the 35-year-old guy in the lineup was in the 20s as well.
Well, maybe because he was little, though. Because didn't you say he was like 5'4"?
Yeah.
So, and she's 8, so maybe she equates someone being short with not being that old.
Yeah, that's fair. That's very fair.
I'm just throwing out these theories.
No, those are all fair things.
But way to rally, Kathy, and recognize the picture.
Finally.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. That must be hard, though.
Well, yeah, she's 8.
Yeah, and she's probably blacked a lot of it out.
Yeah.
I wouldn't want to remember it either.
Yeah.
Absolutely not.
I, again, though, just think it's weird that they didn't know Johnny if he lived around the corner. You know? Because
yeah.
I feel, you know, small town, people know each other. A rural community where people are...
But yeah, but that doesn't necessarily mean that 2 8-year-olds are going to know an 18-year-old.
Well, that's true. And also, if he was a bad kid, the parents probably, like, totally kept him away from them. And so they probably wouldn't have had any idea who he was. Okay, I'm just speculating.
Right. Although he still has little baby half-sisters.
Yeah.
So Maria Maria's childhood friend also testified that she, too, had been offered a piggyback ride.
Ugh.
I knew your face was going to go like that.
Jeez.
By Johnny, who she also identified as McCullough. Three inmates who were imprisoned with McCullough testified that he discussed killing Maria. Their stories, however, were extremely inconsistent because they didn't fit any of the ways that Maria had been murdered. One inmate claimed that he strangled her with a wire. Another claimed that he suffocated her to keep her from screaming. So just they didn't corroborate in the fact that this is actually the cause of death versus, you know, the stories.
Right.
So the defense claimed that Ridolph and Tessier families put pressure on prosecutors and police to solve the case and implicate McCullough despite the fact that there was no physical evidence, no motive, no indication that
motive. He's a fucking piggyback ride given piece of shit.
He's a piggybacker. Or he's a piggyback giver.
Yeah, he's a piggyback ride giver.
Yeah. The fuck?
So creepy.
I know. Huge red flags. I'm never going to look at a piggyback ride the same way again.
Yeah.
Shit's not innocent.
No, it is not.
Red flag.
Yep.
Yeah, so they said that there was no physical evidence, no motive, no indication that McCullough was in the area when Maria was kidnapped. On the recommendation of his attorneys, McCullough did not take the stand in his own defense.
That's pretty smart.
Right? You'd say something super out of whack.
Or you just...
out of whack. Something whack, out of context, or whatever.
Or let the jury know that you're an actual piece of shit by speaking.
Yeah. So he was convicted of kidnapping and murder of Maria Ridolph on September 14th, 2012. And he was sentenced to life in prison with the chance of parole after 20 years. At the time of his sentencing, he was 73 years old.
Oh, good. So he'll be really old if he can get parole.
So this is the time when I want us to, like, jump up and down and be excited. But
Let me guess. Something's going to happen that's going to make me be sad. Bubbles are going to be burst.
Yes. Yeah, I would say let's all cheer, but I think we all need to take a deep breath before this next part.
I don't want to hear it.
So,
but keep going.
McCullough, he filed an appeal for his convictions.
Well, yeah.
Against his convictions. On February 13, 2015, the Illinois Appellate Court, the 2nd District. Appellate.
All right, yep. The appellate court in the house.
Appellate court. All right, do the sentence. On February 13, 2015, the Illinois Appellate Court of the 2nd District maintained his murder conviction.
Good.
But they overturned his convictions for kidnapping and child abduction since they occurred after the 3-year statute of limitations for those offenses expired in 1960. The decision had no bearing, though, on McCullough's life sentence because the sentencing court ordered that the sentences for kidnapping and abduction, like, basically blend together with his murder charge, right? They're not all separate charges.
Mm-hmm.
That they just are basically all one.
Right. I got you.
Despite ruling that Eileen Tessier's, sorry, I don't know
that's
why
what,
I came up with that
I think that's
L.
what we settled on, or you settled on.
Deathbed sentence should not have been entered as evidence against McCullough. The appellate court declined to overturn the murder conviction because Judge Halleck did not rely extensively on the statement when issuing the conviction.
Good.
Yeah. So McCullough, in acting pro se, he filed a petition for post-conviction relief in 2015, requesting that the murder conviction be overturned. So what pro se means is that he's representing himself, mm-hmm. basically, that he's doing everything on his own behalf at this point.
Right, because he thinks his lawyers are stupid pieces of shit and aren't going to be able to get him off. And he's so much smarter than everybody else. Kind of like Ted Bundy.
Right.
Yeah, or some others, but I can't think of them right now because I'm super tired.
Yeah, a lot of them.
Ted Bundy comes right to mind,
though. Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, that he represented himself.
Yeah, okay, he was going to be in law school.
Yes. He was in law school.
Oh, yeah, whatever.
Okay.
He's irrelevant to my life.
Exactly. And this story.
And this story, too, although it could have been him. No, I don't think so. Yeah, too early. Yes. Too soon. After the court initially dismissed McCullough's petition as frivolous and without merit, the public defender who had initially represented McCullough at trial, who had continued to investigate the case while staying in touch with McCullough, despite the fact that he was no longer appointed to the case, petitioned the court to reconsider the dismissal. McCullough filed a subsequent motion, which the state attorney's office could not deny without a hearing. So, in response to the motions, the DeKalb County State's Attorney, Richard Schmack.
Schmack? Schmack? Does he talk some schmack?
Well, I think that's how you would say it.
I like it.
Schmack. Schmack.
Daphne, don't talk schmack. Schmack.
He had taken over at this time for Clay Campbell, and he conducted a detailed assessment of the material, leading Schmack to decide that McCullough could not have committed the crime and was therefore innocent. According to Schmack, I don't want to laugh. This is so funny. According to the S-Man,
Yes.
Yeah, we're going to call him that now so I don't burst out into laughter every time I say that. Even though that's probably even not how it's pronounced, but
It might be. I like it that way.
I do too. I appreciate it.
Me too.
According to the S-Man, there was evidence that clearly showed that McCullough's location on the evening of Maria Ridolph's kidnapping backed his alibi and was excluded from the trial. Phone records from the Illinois Bell, for instance, revealed that McCullough made a collect call to his mother that evening from a payphone in downtown Rockford rather than Sycamore, as reported at his trial.
Okay, so that wasn't true, but if he drove, he could have made a collect call for an alibi.
Right, except for that it was 40 miles away.
Yeah, but he could drive fast.
So, given the date of the phone call, approximately 40-mile distance between Sycamore and Rockford, the icy road conditions, the S-Man concluded that McCullough could not have been in Sycamore at the time that Maria Ridolph went missing.
But the Riddle. S-Man is his court-appointed attorney, right?
Not anymore. He's the new...
Well, I know, but he's the was.
No, the S-Man is not. The S-Man was a different guy.
Okay.
The S-Man took over for the lead prosecutor. He was, the state's prosecutor.
So the state is debunking its own case?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my God. Sorry, it must have not been paying attention right there either.
Clearly, you're going to have to go back. I'm going to make you edit this one so you can listen to it. Following a court hearing in March 2016, Judge William P. Brady of the Illinois Circuit Court annulled McCullough's initial conviction and sentence and ordered a new trial April 15, 2016. McCullough, who was still charged with the crime, was freed on bond until the new trial. That makes no sense. Until the next trial.
Sure.
Don't understand my own notes.
It happens.
And then a week later, Judge Brady dismissed the charges against McCullough altogether. The dismissal of the murder charge was without prejudice, which means that McCullough might face retrial
when he's 104
for the death of Maria Ridolph if a prosecutor so desired to do so. Brady delayed his ruling until after a special prosecutor was appointed to replace the S-Man in the McCullough case, as requested by Maria's brother, Charles Ridolph, and supported by hundreds of Sycamore residents to sign a petition, including the city's mayor also signed this petition. But Judge Brady refused the application for a special prosecutor on October 5th, 2016, and Charles Ridolph said that he would not challenge this decision at all. He would not challenge the ruling for this to get the special prosecutor on the case.
Yeah, no, I understand.
And then on April 12th, 2017, the DeKalb County Circuit Court ruled that McCullough was not guilty of the crime.
Yeah, I don't like it. I see the eyeballs you're giving me. To see if I'm paying attention, and I am, and I'm just absorbing the information.
In response to the motions, the DeKalb County State's Attorney, Richard the S. Mann, who replaced Kay in that position. Again, he looked over all the innocent, or all the information, and he just determined that he was an innocent man. So, that's the end of our case. What are your thoughts on that case, Mom?
Well, I think it's kind of bullshit that somebody can come in and say, oh, nope, he's not guilty, based on a handful of things that may or may not be legit after all these years. Because how can he say that the roads were too icy? Because they literally said that it was just barely snowing and the girls were outside playing, and that's why Kathy had to go home and get her mittens. And so how do they know the roads are too icy?
Right. So I'm sitting in this weird place with this case of, like, I want some more evidence. I want some more evidence on either way. Like, I want some more evidence. Like, I want them to either find the other person that did do it, which is probably not going to happen at this point. It's a 70-year-old case at this point. It's probably not going to happen. Or I want him to get stuck back in jail for it and them to, like, pile more evidence on top of him. I sit in this weird position of I don't know if he actually committed the crime or not because of everything that was happening. And that does seem like a far stretch of distance to travel, to be here, there, and everywhere.
What if he took her with him, though? What if he kidnapped her, had her with him while he made that drive, and then he killed her and then dumped her body?
Yeah, that's all well possible.
Yeah.
I just sit in this weird position. That's why I told you this one was going to be thought-provoking.
Well, I also think that why make up all these stories in between? You know what I mean? That, like, oh, I took the train. Oh, no, I didn't take the train. I drove here. Okay, I'm making a collect call so that I have a timestamp of when I'm making this collect call. And he gets his family to lie for him, saying he's home, but he's really in Chicago anyway.
Right.
Or Rockford. Rockford, Illinois. So he's like, I don't know. I feel like he's probably the most logical suspect.
I think
just based on the suspects that have been presented to me.
I think he's definitely the most logical suspect. I don't know. This kind of just, like,
you just have to look at, I don't know. I mean, we're not court of law people.
We're not, no.
We're just listening to what evidence we have, information. And it's also a 70-year-old case, and so some of it's probably skewed and just based on recounts and not necessarily 100% factual evidence.
Yeah, he's definitely the most likely one. I just wish I had, like, a definitive answer.
Well, I don't think you're going to have one.
I don't think I am either.
Which sucks.
That's why I don't love unsolved true crime cases.
Same.
I'm like, I want the answer and I want it now.
Want resolution. But on that note, people are innocent that you think have been found guilty, that you quote unquote have resolution, and then it turns out that they're not really guilty. So there's maybe not always resolution, even if there is resolution.
Right. I mean, that could very well be the same for this dude. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess we'll never know, really, unless they take him back to trial.
Yeah, but either way, he's a piece of crap because he's...
Yeah, either way, he sucks.
Yeah, he's a child molester.
Yeah.
Yep. So anyway, thanks for that, Daff. I appreciate that. I appreciate you doing the work on that one.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and that was interesting. And I will go back and listen to the parts that maybe I wasn't so clear on.
I think you should go back and listen to all of this. What good editing practice for you.
Yeah, all right. Good night.
Take care.
Thanks for listening.
That's disturbing.